Thank you. So good evening, everyone. Good to see you. People on Zoom, good evening. Wasn't it a beautiful day today? Yeah. Kate and I went for a walk run. Kate walks, I run today. And working in the garden. It was so nice to be out in the garden planting things and working in the dirt. It's also wonderful to sit outside, if you can find a quiet place to sit outside under a tree or in the garden somewhere, even for a few minutes, following the breath. Very nourishing. Well, tonight I'm going to be giving the second talk on the Xinxin Ming, or the faith in mind, trust in mind. It's translated in different ways. It's as you can see from the handout, for those of you who are new here, it's a long poem, a teaching poem, that is being chanted in the Zen monasteries, or Chan monasteries, in China, Korea, Japan, for centuries, and still is chanted today, and a lot of talks are given on it today in various places. So welcome to the second session. And the first one is posted online if you want to catch up, if you missed that one. So maybe let's begin by reading some of the verses together. We can just read them together. And we'll start at the beginning. We'll read all the way down through the first column there, and then the first stanza on the second column. Does that make sense? So let's just read it together. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. When neither love nor hate arises, all is clear and undisguised. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth. If you wish to know the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the fundamental nature of things is not recognized, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. The way is perfect as vast space is perfect, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Indeed, it is due to our grasping and rejecting that we do not know the true nature of things. Live neither in the entanglements of outer things, nor in the ideas and feelings of emptiness. Be serene and at one with things, and erroneous views will disperse by themselves. When you try to stop activity to achieve quietude, your very efforts fill you with activity. As long as you remain attached to one extreme or another, you will never know oneness. Those who do not live in the single way cannot be free in activity or quietude, in assertion or denial. Denial the reality of things and you miss their reality. Assert the emptiness of things and you miss their reality. The more you talk and think about it, the further you wander from the truth. So cease attachments to talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know.
Thank you.
So, well, try to get through that part today, hopefully. But I just wanted to return to that first sentence for a moment. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. Sometimes preferences is translated as picking and choosing. I think this one sentence has been translated in so many ways into English. As I mentioned, there are at least 30 different translations that I found on the internet. And of course, translated into many other languages too. This is a very famous teaching poem. And repeated by many Dharma teachers in China, Japan, Korea, for hundreds and hundreds of years, as I mentioned earlier. In One brief sentence, the author, Sengsan, summarized, I think, the very heart of Buddhist practice. Not to engage in assumptions, judgments, opinions, preferences, distinctions. In other words, when we let go of our constant separating and othering, when we let go of all of that, then the unity of things just naturally is revealed. And sometimes we experience intimations of this, moments of this, right? Out in nature, perhaps, quiet moment by ourselves, suddenly all that endless chatter in the mind drops away and we're just in the woods. Or the ski slope, or the hockey arena, or in the music. And yet, of course, we live our life in an ongoing stream of assumptions, judgments, opinions, preferences, and distractions, caught in our view of a separate self. And this poem challenges us to look and probe beyond that seemingly thick wall of me against the world, me between everything else. And the question, the boundary between self and the rest of reality, to disengage from the abstract or kind of, I guess abstract conceptual reality that our mind kind of creates. You know, we tell our stories about ourselves, about other people, about the world, to kind of let go of that and enter into a much more spacious place. So, I think last Wednesday I got through the whole title and the first stanza. So let's continue with the second stanza. If you wish to know the truth, then hold to no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. Now, this translation is not very poetic. It kind of clunks along. At least that's my feeling. And there are other translations that have a little or a lot more kind of interest to them, poetic interest to them. But this translation, when I was looking at the Chinese, is actually pretty close. So although it clunks, I think it's a little bit closer to the Chinese. Not that I don't read Chinese, really. I read Japanese, but I can read the Chinese characters, and this seems pretty close. So, when you wish to know the truth, then hold to no opinions for or against anything. Now, this sentence gave me pause. Sengsan is asking if we wish to know the truth. And I ask myself, do I wish to know the truth? Do I really want to know the truth? I mean, yeah, right? Isn't that great? Yeah, of course I want to know the truth. But I wonder, and looking at the numerous books on self-help and spirituality at places like Banyan Books, for example, I'm often struck by how many of the covers have these good feel messages, right? I guess in order to sell, you have to have a good feel message on the jacket. But pausing for a moment and considering that the truth may go against my own cherished beliefs, ideas, and preferences, do I still want to pursue the path leading to truth? I don't know what the truth is. We have these ideas, right? But in reality, it's like jumping off a cliff. We don't know what we will meet. And even a brief introduction to the Buddhist path makes it clear that our sense of who we think we are, what we think we are, our conditioned identity, all of that will be deeply challenged. unlike the teachings in so many of the self-help books and the spiritual kind of marketplace promoters, the Buddhist path is not about fixing you. The Buddhist path is not interested in fixing the self. It offers a radical different option. Sensong is warning us to question if we simply want to affirm our ideas and preferences, you know, put a little shine on us. That's all I want, a little shine. So people will like me a little more. Is that what we want? Or do we want to see through our ideas and preferences, etc., to see through them, to take them apart, all the while not knowing what lies underneath? In response to a question about enlightenment, Suzuki Roshi, the Japanese teacher who first brought this kind of practice to North America, once said, "Well, you know, some of you may be enlightened someday, and you may not like it." This is one of those mysteries, I think, and paradoxes of the spiritual journey. We yearn for something, but we do not see it clearly. We may experience intimations, but I think for the most part, we don't know the end of the journey. So, as the poem goes, to hold no opinions for or against. Now, this is really another way to express beginner's mind. And again, referring to Suzuki Roshi, he famously said, "If your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few." Empty mind means a mind that is equanimous, serene, a mind that is not engaging in distinctions and separations and judgments and evaluations. It's just fully present. And as I mentioned last week, this poem about not holding preferences is talking about these preferences we have in regard to our self-identity, that sense of me on the inside against the world on the outside, and nurturing our preferences. These kind of preferences is the mechanism by which we affirm ourselves as being separate, as being different from the world, and against the world often. I'm right, you're wrong. She's good, he's bad. Everyone's out to get me. I'm no good, etc., etc. It could be also, I'm the best. Still the same. Very early on in the Pali text, the Buddha said very clearly, don't judge yourself, don't compare yourself to others. I'm better, or I'm no good, she's better. Don't do that, don't do that. And I'm the same, I'm equal. Buddha said, don't do that. Don't do it. Just don't do it. Not good, not bad, not the same. Because that too is a kind of preference. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. Indeed, it is the dis-ease of the mind. Or maybe we could say the dis-ease of the heart. Because in Chinese and Japanese, it's the same thing, as I mentioned. Like and dislike seem a little mild to me, though, in this case. The disease that Shenyan Sengtsan is referring to is called tanha in Pali. And tanha, the original meaning of the word tanha, is thirst. A constant thirst. And I think thirst is a really appropriate metaphor for this preferences, picking and choosing, actually. Because the nature of tanha, which we can break down into craving and aversion, right? Get me out of here. I thirst to get away, or I thirst for something else. The thirst for things to be a certain way, a thirst for things not to be as they are, right? The other day, someone was telling me about this wonderful new ice cream made with goat's milk or goat cheese and something.
Sour cherries.
Right. So you can thirst for that ice cream, and you go home, but someone has eaten it all. And so the thirst turns into a different kind of thirst, an aversion to the empty carton, and maybe to the person who ate it all. So tanha, this thirst, says in the early text, is pervasive in our lives, persistent and reoccurring. Those three qualities: pervasive, persistent, and reoccurring. Pervasive in that the mind is constantly telling us we need something, or that we need to push something else away. This, for example, like watching a video. Desire comes for a snack. Or when driving, maybe some music would be pleasant. So just immediately the mind is like, something else, right? Or maybe when listening to our partner and you'd wish they would pause for a moment so that we could interject our important opinions and ideas into the conversation. And yet once a craving is satisfied, a new craving arrives on its coattails, right? Very soon afterwards. A flicker of boredom occurs, and then suddenly aversion arises, right? I don't want to be bored. And so my attention shifts to something else. The mystery novel gets a bit dry, and I wonder what's on TV. The boyfriend is no longer so shiny now. And the eyes notice this handsome person across the room. It seems we cannot sustain contentment. I don't want to be stuck in traffic, to be sick, to be lonely. Beam me out of here, Scotty. The mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. Oops, I missed a part. When the fundamental nature of things is not recognized, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. The way is perfect as vast space is perfect, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. The Mahayana Buddhist tradition teaches that the fundamental nature of all things is shunyata, or emptiness. Shunyata is a Sanskrit word, emptiness. And the great Indian teacher and philosopher, Nagarjuna, explained shunyata, or emptiness, as this. He said, all things are in perpetual process of arising and passing away, ever becoming, and thus never actually being. In other words, nothing we see, hear, or are stands alone or stands still. Everything is a momentary expression of one seamless, ever-changing environment. And for this, Thich Nhat Hanh coined the word interbeing to describe that nothing has a permanent, fixed identity, but everything flows with everything else. When we don't recognize this truth, our mind is often caught in like and dislike, craving and aversion. We don't want the empty ice cream carton. We want the full ice cream carton. Me versus them, we engage in the process of selfing, creating and holding on to the self. The internal chatter, endlessly comparing, judging, criticizing, separating over and over and over again. And so in contrast to this, Sengsan tells us there is another possibility. He says the way is perfect as vast space is perfect, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Now last week I mentioned that the Great Way refers to the path of awakening, the path of being fully alive, fully aware. And this is just one expression amongst many that our ancestors created for us, kind of pointing us towards the ineffable, right? So the Chinese word Dao, or way, the way, the path, represents the natural working of the universe, which flows through all things, connecting and enabling all functioning. It is the natural flowing of the universe. And us, of course. Often used in Chinese Buddhist literature as a synonym for Buddha nature, and other words like that. The teachings tell us we too are part of the Tao, already perfect and complete. But we don't feel that way very often, do we? We don't feel perfect and complete. Our sense of separation arises from the tanha, the constant thirst that seems to be present, clinging and aversion, making it challenging for us to really see and deeply appreciate the truth that nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. How do we make that alive and real in our lives right now? This is the root of our practice. Indeed, going back to the poem, indeed it is true, indeed it is due to our grasping and rejecting that we do not know the true nature of things. Live neither in the entanglements of outer things nor in the ideas or feelings of emptiness. Be serene and at one with things, and erroneous views will disappear by themselves. So in this passage, the author gives us practice instructions, and he gives us some encouragement. What prevents us from a vast, inclusive view of life is our reactive, self-centered grasping and pushing away, is what he's telling us. He tells us, be aware when entanglement arises from grasping and pushing away. Notice it. Train yourself to, here again I'm pushing away. Here again I'm hanging on. But also avoid, he writes, the assumption that emptiness or samadhi or some pure state is where we should strive to abide. He tells us not to strive for the ice cream cone that will never fall and never diminish, no matter how many bites you take. Instead, return to a place of calm, of stable equanimity. This is returning to the very basis of our practice, meeting each moment fully, exactly as it is. And of course, at that moment, reactions may arise, but we learn to see them and as reactions and not give them life. Just, there's anger again. There's that feeling of being pissed off at that person. But not enacting. There is, Sengsan tells us, well, let me put it this way. He says, It's there. When we are connected, at one with all things, all the erroneous views will disappear themselves. All our conceptual ideas of separation and judgments and evaluations, they just disappear. When you try to stop activity to achieve quietude, your very effort fills you with activity. As long as you remain attached to one extreme or another, you will never know oneness. Those who do not live in the single way cannot be free in either activity or quietude, in assertion or denial. Well, many times, folks completely new to this practice will tell me despondently after their first sitting, or maybe a couple of sittings, "Michael, my mind was just chattering away. I can't quiet down at all. This practice is not for me." And of course, this is something we all experience, right? Those times when our mind will just not shut up. So I tell newcomers, please don't direct your effort to calming your thoughts. Just return to the breath over and over again. And I give them a few tips. But this line, these lines of this poem introduced the very Chinese concept of wu wei, which literally translates as no trying, no doing. Wu Wei. Have you heard of that before? Yeah, a lot of people have. And perhaps some of you are familiar with that term. Maybe you've done Tai Chi, for example, or Qigong. Wu Wei. No doing. The same with our practice on the cushion. Not making strong effort to make our mind be a certain way. Returning over and over again to the present moment, the breath, the body. There's a book I recommend about Wu Wei if you're interested by a UBC professor, Edward Slingerland. It's called Trying Not to Try. Cute title, eh? But a very interesting book. He's a professor in Asian studies, but also comparative religion and cognitive science. So he has his finger in a number of different pies. A very brilliant guy. And he writes, his writing is very accessible if you're interested in this book. And Wu Wei, I'd recommend it. So he describes Wu Wei like this. He says, it refers to the dynamic, effortless, and unself-conscious state of mind of a person who is optimally active and effective. Sounds like a management course, right? People feel as if they are doing nothing, while at the same time they may be creating a brilliant work of art, smoothly negotiating a complex social situation, or even bringing the entire world into a harmonious order. This state of harmony is both complex and holistic, involving, as it does, the integration of the body, emotions, and the mind. In other words, we are in the flow. Right. That's Wu Wei, as he describes it, in the flow. And we have all experienced being in the flow at times. Driving a car, down a ski slope, playing music, hiking. So as the poem says, when we try to calm our mind, when we try to awaken, when we struggle, we simply add to the chaos. Shut up, damn it. And the reason for this is that we're trying to fix things according to our preferences. I prefer a quiet mind, thank you. Not this endless chatter. So we remain attached to one extreme or another. And Wu Wei gives us a counterbalance, a corrective to our relentless self-centeredness, our effort to fix and improve. Sheng Yin, the Chinese Chan or Zen teacher who recently passed away, puts it this way, this idea of letting go of effort. He writes, "If you try to eliminate the ups and downs, it would be like observing a pan of water. There are gentle ripples on its surface, but you want the surface to be completely still. So you blow on the water to flatten it out. And this creates more ripples. Then you press the water with your hands to stop it from moving. And the outcome, of course, is even more agitation. If you were to leave the water alone, the ripples would eventually subside and the surface would be still." That's our practice. The single way referred to in the poem, of course, is oneness. Or maybe it's even beyond oneness. What would that be? So the last little stanza here that I want to cover tonight. "Deny the reality of things and you miss their reality. Assert the emptiness of things and you miss their reality. The more you talk and think about it, the further you wander from the truth. So cease attachments to talking and thinking, and there's nothing you will not be able to know." Today, at our house, the lilacs are blooming. We live a little high up, so maybe we're a little bit behind Vancouver. In childhood, lilacs were one of my favorite flowers, and I still deeply appreciate the scent of lilacs. So how could I deny their unique reality? Is it not true? We all want to be appreciated for our uniqueness. We all want to be loved for the bundle of qualities that make up who we are. And don't we become somewhat sad or complain when we feel unappreciated? Yet there is more, I believe. There is a longing to be appreciated and loved for the wholeness, our wholeness with all beings. There is a longing to be appreciated and loved for our wholeness with all things. So taken up in our desire to be seen and accepted for our uniqueness, our unique gifts, we become unable to name perhaps a deeper yearning. To be acknowledged for our silent bond with all beings. The love that is boundless, ungraspable, where we are all together, all equal. Sengsan, the author, tells us again not to fall into duality, into separation. Valuing oneness over diversity, that's also a mistake. Sticking to oneness, which Zen students, especially during Sesshin, sometimes fall into during retreats, is called the Zen disease. In his famous essay called the Genjo Koan, Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who brought this form of practice from China into Japan way back in the 1200s, Dogen wrote this famous passage: "To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away." Here's the key note. "No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly." It's not about enlightenment. we go beyond that too. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. So both Sengsan and Dogen warn us not to try abide in some kind of sweet awakening state. We have to let go of that too. And this is quite mysterious. And I don't think it's a riddle our rational mind can really solve. Because as Sengsang says, the more you talk about it, the further you wander from the truth. So let go. Please, and fully enter your experience. And I better stop here. So thank you for listening, and I think we have time for a little kind of group getting together and having a little few words for each other. So here's what I'd like you to talk about. I'd like you to remember a time when you were in the flow, or when you went with the flow. And what was that experience like for you? That flow experience where you kind of disappear and you're just, something else is flowing through you. Or, do you have an example of when you gave up the idea of being right? Or wrong? Or better? Or worse? And you simply went with what was happening. Not capitulating. But there was a letting go. Some sense also entering the flow, perhaps. And how might you cultivate that a little bit, whatever one of those you choose? And if none of those seem really interesting, what are your thoughts about the poem so far?